You're listening to a 3CR podcast recorded in the 3CR Community Radio Studio in Melbourne, Australia. If you like what you hear, please consider donating or subscribing so we can keep bringing you more independent community content. For more information, go to 3cr.org.au.
Hello and welcome to Uprise Radio. My name is Koshin and I'd like to begin by acknowledging the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, whose land I am recording from. On today's episode, we have a very special interview to present with Greg Barnes, SC. Greg Barnes is, among many things, a barrister, a legal advisor for Julian Assange and the WikiLeaks group. He was the political campaigns director for the Australian Republican Movement during the 1999 referendum and a longtime human rights advocate. And I wanted to talk to Greg about the state of international law today, given the massive erosion to international law that we are witnessing. I think it's a really interesting interview, and I don't want to say too much before we get into it. So I will just press play. I hope you enjoy. All right. So, hi, Greg. How's it going?
Good, thank you.
Good. Let's begin. And I want to start by talking about the recent events in Venezuela. But before we get to the recent, the kidnapping or capture of Maduro, I wanted to start by just talking about what began last year with the bombing of these boats in international waters off the coast of Venezuela. Is there a precedent for this? What is your read on the reaction to this and the escalation of these attacks on boats in international waters?
Well, I think the consensus view, and I haven't heard anything to the contrary, the consensus view is that these were and have been illegal actions. They've been illegal actions for a number of reasons. Firstly, this is not a military context. The so-called war on drugs has been around, sadly, for 50 years or more now. Even in its worst manifestations, it's never been a military operation, if you like, in the strict sense. And of course, there was no evidence that these boats were carrying drugs. And so one can only conclude that the conduct of the United States was unlawful, and therefore the taking of these lives was, state-sanctioned murder.
Mm. I want to ask you about that, about the presentation of evidence, because I've notice more and more there's claims, especially with international incidents, governments will declare a crime has been committed, but there's often very little evidence actually presented. Is this something that's, is this something that you've noticed is increasing? Is this sort of traditionally how things work when discussing international law? I've noticed huge sweeping declarations and really no documents provided.
Yeah, no, I mean, this is a rogue. The Trump administration is a rogue administration. It's a corrupt administration. It's a criminal administration. It has no regard for international law. And what's worse about it is that, it criticizes, the West criticizes Vladimir Putin, criticizes Xi Jinping. If they commit actions which are deemed to be unlawful, illegal at international law, and yet there's relative silence in relation to the United States. I mean, there's no doubt that powerful nations do commit breaches of international law. I mean, some of the conduct of China in the South China Sea has been conjectural. I think there's no doubt there have been breaches of international law by Russia. But what we're seeing in the United States is something that is on a very broad scale, in relation to Venezuela, for example. Generally speaking, we saw Trump, talking about, musing on the idea of military takeover of Greenland, of Canada. And so this is a rogue administration. I mean, it's an administration also that backs other rogue administrations, of course, and the criminal and terrorist administration that's run by Benjamin Netanyahu in Israel.
Mm. Yeah, I also, the videos that have been released by the US of these bombings, I wanted to get your take on this because there's an interesting comparison that I've heard with the collateral murder video that was released on WikiLeaks, where a decade ago a video of military cameras showing the murder of individuals without any due process would have been scandalous or at least embarrassing for an administration. But now in 2026 or 2025, when the videos first started coming out, we're at a point where the US is proudly showing these videos of people being annihilated by this by their drones.
It's a very good point you make. I mean, I worked on the Assange campaign, and collateral murder did shock everyone. I mean, I think for many people, it was this is what America does. I mean, we saw this in Vietnam, which was exposed by Seymour Hersh, a great journalist. But this now is done. And as you rightly say, it gets media stories, but people then move on to the next outrage. And that's what's so shocking about it, that criminal actions can be committed, breaches of international law can be committed by the United States, the so-called upholder of the rule of law, and the West just sits back and watches.
And obviously this escalated to the capture, the kidnapping of President Maduro at the start of this year. The response I have been really astounded by internationally, the lack of condemnation from countries that talk a lot about international law. Did you have anything you would like to say about that briefly?
Well, look, I think that what you can do in this relation to this particular issue is you can, walk and chew gum at the same time, I think, to use Lyndon Johnson's expression. That is, you can take the view that the Maduro regime was a corrupt regime, that Maduro didn't have legitimacy, was a repressive and oppressive regime. That's a view shared by many, many people. But of course, you can take that view, but it doesn't excuse the unlawfulness of what was done. I mean, it was the same with Saddam Hussein. The West took a view, and many Western countries took a view, that it was an odious regime. But the false pretext to then go in and invade, capture Hussein, etc., was of course unlawful. So, but it seems to be that the West says, "Oh, well, we don't like Maduro, so that's okay." But if this was done in relation to, for example, a right-wing dictatorship in Central America, of which there are some, if it was Milei, for example, in Argentina, although to be fair, Argentina is a democracy, but if he was seized by the Americans, there'd be outrage. But international law has to be complied with consistently. You can't pick and choose.
Yeah, definitely. And I find the precedent setting is incredibly dangerous. I mean, there's nothing really to stop other actors from taking the same action in terms of what's allowed and what's not. I mean, what now stands between Putin and kidnapping? It's a
I
dangerous
mean,
precedent.
rightly, China and Russia rightly would look at this and say, "Why pick on us?" In fact, the criminal conduct of the Trump administration is as odious as that of many other regimes in the world that we say we condemn. And yet, as I say, we sit back. But this, of course, has always been the hypocrisy of the West. We create international law, we talk about the rule of law, and then we make exceptions because it suits us. That, of course, is the creates the cynicism in the global South, and you can understand it.
I wanted to also just quickly mention the designation of narco-terrorism as a justification for all of this. And I find it really interesting that there's been a history of terrorism being a designation that sort of then creates the legal blind spot that just allows for killing without any due process. But the narco, the revival of the term narco-terrorism in a new context by the US, do you see this as an expansion that could potentially continue to expand? That do you see this as something, that could keep rolling or?
Well, I mean, terrorism, of course, has a very specific meaning, and it means the use of violence in order to further a political objective or to a form of political advocacy that's unlawful because it does have violence at its centre. And that's the definition of terrorism in Australia in the criminal law, and that's as we understand it with things like, 9/11, the London bombings, etc. To call drug trafficking terrorism is simply to enable governments to murder people, to avoid or to take dramatic steps because they say we're stopping terrorists getting into country into the country. I mean, it's nonsense, arrant nonsense, and it's dangerous, but it's deliberately done. So what are we going to have next? Let's say we have a problem with overfishing that the United States doesn't like. Are they now terrorists, those who are overfishing? It's just a misused term, and deliberately so, to enable human rights abuses, cold-blooded murders, and of course, laced with hypocrisy, because the biggest users of drugs in the world is the United States, including I could you would be London to a brick, Donald Trump's friends, and there'd be plenty of coke at Mar-a-Lago.
Yeah, definitely. No, yeah, and also with the, I mean, with the terrorism designation as well, we've seen with these ICE operations in Minneapolis, now a second person has been killed, and the administration has immediately labeled them as a domestic terrorist without any
I
trial
mean,
or any, just
in
instantly.
relation to ICE, ICE are again are thugs. There's a condemnation of the Chinese for having overly aggressive policing and security services, same in, many other countries, Zimbabwe, etc. This is what ICE is. I mean, ICE goes around murdering people. And I've seen that video this morning. I saw it in the New York Times. It's abundantly clear they murdered him. ICE is really the stormtroopers for the Trump administration.
Yeah, so I wanted to now move to a more macro kind of look at this. Venezuela is sort of a case study of this broader erosion of international law that we've seen accelerating in recent years with the genocide in Gaza and a total lack of response from many countries. I mean, there's been certain kind of South Africa has stepped up, but certainly in Australia, the response has been incredibly tepid from the government. The so-called 12-day war in Iran. It's again, it's sort of you can have whatever opinion you want of the regime in Iran, but it does not legitimize or make legal the bombing of a sovereign country with
Great.
without any self-defense. And yeah, so I wanted to get your perspective on this. Do you think that there is a broad-scale erosion of international law, that this is sort of a collapse, or is this a hiccup?
I think it's collapse. I think what's significant, though, is that there are countries that are stepping up, Spain, Ireland, South Africa in particular, Brazil. These are countries that are shaming countries like Australia. I mean, the UK, Australia, the European Union, weak in the main, weak, but not only weak, in their weakness, compliant with what's happening, and in some senses aiding and abetting or turning a blind eye at the very best to the undoubted genocide in Gaza, but also the fact that Israel is an apartheid state.
Yeah. No, it's incredibly disappointing, especially with Albanese making many comments and a speech at the UN, which on paper sounded pretty good about the need for countries like Australia to uphold international law, but then refusing to step up when it comes
Well,
to Israel.
and I mean, worse still, refusing to call Israel an apartheid state because he says apartheid is a word that pertains only to South Africa. Well, that's not right. It emanates from South Africa, but that doesn't mean that it's not being played out in other parts of the world. It clearly is.
And I wanted to contrast this with the Russian invasion of Ukraine, which also an illegal invasion, but the response was basically what you would want to what you would expect to see from one nation conducting an illegal operation into another nation and violating their sovereignty. And yeah, why do you think it's what makes it so easy when it's for us to call out and sanction countries that aren't
Well,
our
because
friends?
because that's the way the world works, and also, in relation to Europe, it still has a Cold War mindset. I mean, it should have wound up NATO at the end of, when the wall came down in 1989. I mean, that was the end of the matter, but it kept poking the bear, in this case, the Russian bear. But Australia does it as well. The statements it makes at the UN and elsewhere in relation to Iran, previously Syria. I mean, I don't have any brief for those regimes whatsoever, but you can't on the one hand condemn Iran and on the other hand be welcoming to Australia an enabler of genocide in the president of Israel. I mean, you can't do it. I mean, it would be unthinkable for Albanese to invite the leadership, of the leadership in Iran. Unthinkable. The News Limited papers would go berserk, as would a number of communities in Australia. But it's okay to invite the Israeli president in the current circumstances. I mean, that's the hypocrisy.
Yeah, definitely. I wanted to sort of trace this back to what I see is the more recent and egregious displays of violations of international law. I sort of see the invasion of Iraq as kind of let's say the hinge point where from then on it sort of felt like international law maybe was kind of damaged to a point that it would have been incredibly hard to put it back in the bottle. Do you share that view? Do you think that a lot of this can be traced back to the invasion of Iraq? Or do you think that after the invasion of Iraq, things could have been put back on track?
Well, I think the invasion of Iraq was illegal. Those who joined the Americans breached international law, of course, including Australia. And of course, we saw Abu Ghraib, we saw the torture committed by the Americans, and the rest of the world says, well, me too. Why should we be complying with you? You tell us we've got to comply with the rule of law when you don't comply with the rule of law. But that goes back a while. I mean, the Vietnam War, of course, was unlawful. We've seen other conflicts right throughout Latin America in the 1970s and 80s when the Americans intervened in elections, all unlawful conduct. I think on the other hand, you had, of course, the first Bush administration getting UN support for the first Gulf conflict, and you saw the European Union trying to prevent the slaughter of people in the former Yugoslavia with the intervention in relation to Kosovo. They stand in contrast, whilst not perfect, they stand in contrast to what happened in Iraq. And I think since Iraq, we have seen a breakdown of that global architecture. And mainly because I think people say the Obama administration, was better. But, I mean, the Obama administration, I think There were more drone attacks and drone killings under the Obama administration than any other administration in the United States. So I think the real issue here is the United States, because it is the so-called leader of the free world. But of course, it's an empire in decline and exhibiting all of the characteristics of an empire in decline, and that is committing unlawful actions, an arrogant, dangerous administration in Washington, occupied by nutters.
No, I definitely agree as well with the comments on Obama. I mean, Trump is obviously a some sort of representation of something new, but at the same time, it is in many ways a continuation of the trajectory. It's sort of, yeah, there's a lot of similarities. Earlier on in the week, during the big meeting in Davos, Mark Carney, the Canadian Prime Minister, made a speech which has been much talked about in the last few days. It's caused some controversy. It's also garnered a lot of support from a lot of people in Australia as well. It's received a lot of praise. What do you think about his speech and his declaration that this is a rupture of the rules-based order? And that it's time to stop pretending. And I think the phrase used was to take the sign out of the window, in reference to Soviet shopkeepers pretending that communism was a viable system.
I think he's right. I think it was a great speech, but the Canadians have always had more guts on this stuff than Australia. Mark Carney's speech was a speech that should have been given by other world leaders, including, Anthony Albanese here, and it ought to be the benchmark moving forward. And it was a necessary antidote to the cowardice of the European Union, the cowardice of countries like the UK and Australia.
Do you find any hypocrisy in the use of this rhetoric only being used now that Western countries are being coerced by the United States in the same way that many countries outside of the West have been coerced in the past?
Well, I think Western countries have been happy to see developing world countries and the global South, the BRICS as they call them, being coerced over many years. I mean, they've condemned, there's been condemnation of South Africa for having relationships with Russia and China. Why shouldn't they? Why shouldn't they do that? The West has been sanctimonious for years. It's turned a blind eye when it suits it. It's done the Americans' bidding. And now, of course, you've got the Americans, which have, I mean, they've always been rogue, but they've really gone rogue. And Europe is now either going to shape up or alternatively allow itself to be rolled. The world is just breaking down into power blocks. In some ways, well, in one way, the decline of the United States is a positive for the world. The United States is not a force for good. It's a force for malevolence. It's hypocritical. It's a malevolent influence in the world and has been for many years. Having China as a counterbalance, I don't think is any bad thing. There are many faults and problems with China, but one of them isn't the is that they don't go around the world trying to take over other countries.
And how do you see Australia's role as a middle power, which Mark Carney really spoke about? He really focused the speech on the role of middle powers in, shifting how countries are going to interact with each other in the future and forming blocs in order to stand up to the great powers. How do you see Australia's role in the future, and what actions could or should Australia be taking?
Well, get out of AUKUS. I mean, why the hell would anyone in this region turn its back on its neighbours like Indonesia and Malaysia and others by involving itself as, a satellite of the United States in this absurd China containment strategy. That's the first thing. The second thing to do is to stand up against the Americans, to stop talking about the importance of the alliance, to do what Mark Carney said and say, we are a middle power. You know, have an independent foreign policy. It's the sort of fear in this country of having an independent foreign policy. I mean, New Zealand adopted a more independent foreign policy, of course, 40 years ago when David Longley, the then Prime Minister, stood up to the Americans on nuclear powered ships coming into port in New Zealand and the ban on them. You know, that was unthinkable in Australia. But, you know, you have to have an independent foreign policy in a multipolar world. And the problem with Australia is it's backed the wrong horse for too many years.
Why do you think, what do you think the aversion is to formal independence in Australia? Speaking as well about, our history of republicanism.
Yeah, well, you know, I ran the Republic campaign in 99. I was chair of the Republican movement. I mean, that, you know, Australians essentially, you know, in many ways, forelock tuggers. You know, they forelock tugged to the United Kingdom for many, many years and still do so. You know, they don't mind the fact that no Australian can ever be their head of state. They sought the protection of the United States in World War II, rightly so. John Curtin did the right thing in the pivot to the US because the UK had sold out Australia in Southeast Asia. But what we've done is essentially said that's where we're going to sit. And so we sit in the Pacific and the Asia Pacific region as a nation which is out of step with that region. You know, we still have a British monarch. We celebrate a day, January 26, which constituted an invasion, and even in terms of the law at that time, an unlawful invasion, which created genocide and continues to. And we are fearful of stepping out on our own when it comes to the United States. This absurd fear. I mean, linking into AUKUS is no better than, you know, putting troops on the ground in Vietnam. It's another example of not just stupidity, but danger for Australia, and particularly the way it's viewed within the region. The only Prime Minister who's really got this is Paul Keating, who really got the notion of Australian independence and Australia's need to be in the region. But the others have not and have failed Australia as a consequence.
Yeah, I'm always surprised by the lack of public support for becoming a republic. I've never really been able to understand why there's not just it's not a 90% to 10%
Yeah.
support in Australia.
That's partly because you haven't had a prime minister to drive it. When Paul Keating drove the issue, we had polling up over 50%. It was John Howard who destroyed the opportunity through his Machiavellian tactics in the lead up to the referendum. But if you get leadership on this issue, you can see a change. But, you know, I think the only way we're going to become a republic is if New Zealand says time to move on, Canada says time to move on, because these are the largest nations in the Commonwealth still with a British head of state. Jamaica, Barbados, African countries, they've all moved on, they've grown up. And here we are, poor old Australia, you know, sitting out here in the Pacific, hanging on to the apron strings of a classist, prejudiced, and utterly useless group of people whose time has well passed its use-by date in the United Kingdom, let alone Australia.
No, it would be good to talk a bit more about that, but I'll move on. I just wanted to quickly touch on before we wrap up on the these new hate speech laws that have passed in Australia. I do see them as sort of related to this, the legal blind spot of anything kind of touching on national security and terrorism. I just wanted to ask, what is, if you were to make a case, I know that you're in opposition to them, if you were to try to explain what even is the sort of the motivation to pass laws like this when we already have terrorism laws that exist, if you already are found to be a member, or there are already rules that you can break. So what's the need to bring in rules that sort of create this shortcut almost, where they can just say that you're in association in some way, and therefore they'll label you as equally guilty?
Politics. There's no other reason. I mean, this is driven by a response to Bondi. Bondi was a shocking event for which one can only say it was a massacre. It was appalling. But legislation on the back of such tragedies and terrible events is generally not a good idea. This legislation is appallingly drafted. It's dangerous, and it will see gross injustice. I can say that fortunately, in my profession, there is going to be, I think, a large network of lawyers prepared to take on these laws and act for people. And it's going to embolden security, police, ASIO, politicians. It's going to embolden them to take tougher action in relation to protesters and to close down protest. You know, these sort of laws have an insidious effect because you couple them with existing laws, and what you see is a suite of so-called security laws in this country, most of which can be abused, some of which are abused.
Do you see the undermining of rule of law and the erosion of international law as connected? Is it just by
Well, I think
chance
so. I mean,
that's.
it's a mentality, you know. I mean, the reason, for example, that some countries like South Africa take human rights more seriously is one, where that country's come from, two, and two, they have a very strong human rights oriented constitutional and political structure. And it's a country with enormous problems, but when it comes to South Africa and Israel, for example, they have been leaders. So, you know, not only in domestic law on human rights, but on international.
Well, yeah, great. Thank you so much. I just have one final question to wrap things up. Do you have a sense of hope for the future of international law? Do you think that that the genie can be put back in the bottle, that things can be repaired without the need for the sorts of events that led to, previous iterations, without a new world war in order to create the motivation
Well,
for a.
that's the yeah. I mean, that's the issue. I mean, you're right. I mean, that's the issue, that sometimes it needs a terrible catalyst to restructure. I mean, we've done it twice in the 20th century. You know, we did the Treaty of Versailles, didn't work. We created the United Nations, which has been a force for good overall, but now we're witnessing a breakdown of that order. It's difficult to say where it's going to go. I mean, one way of looking at it is to say, when Trump goes in 4 years, if, for example, Gavin Newsom became president, the Democratic governor of California, and who is quite impressive on some fronts, that some of this might be restored. That America, whilst I think is generally speaking a malevolent force in many ways, would be less threatening and at least put together and repair some of the damage that's being done. But I think, you know, this is at the moment the breakdown in international order. And what happens next, I think, is very, very difficult to predict.
Well, thank you so much, Greg, for joining
Thank you.
us. And thank you so much for sharing your insight, your expertise. I appreciate it. Thanks so much.
No problem at all. No, that was great.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.